Support for Southbound comes from WFAE members and Southeast Radiation Oncology Group, offering non-invasive alternatives to surgery and treatments in radiation oncology. Details at treatcancer.com.
Hey, y'all. I'm Tommy Tomlinson. And from WFAE in Charlotte, this is Southbound. Gail Jessup White has American history running through her veins. Her family tree traces back to Thomas Jefferson, her third president. It also traces back to Sally Hemings, Jefferson's slave, who gave birth to six children likely fathered by Jefferson. It took decades for Gail to make these connections and to process what they mean for her and her family.
It was multi-generational. It was interlocking for decades, generations, and these were blood relations that we live with today.
Now she works at Monticello, Jefferson's home, where part of her job as community engagement officer is to tell her story as a way to tell America's story. Here's our conversation. Gail Jessup White, I want to start at the beginning of your knowledge about your family history. When did you find out that you were related to Thomas Jefferson, and when did you find out you were also related to Sally Hemings?
So, Tommy, it's really interesting, actually, how I found out I was related to Thomas Jefferson, which I learned long before I confirmed or learned about the Hemings connection. I sort of stumbled upon it. I grew up in Washington, D.C., the youngest of five children. My oldest sister is 19 years older than I, so in a way she was old enough to be my mother. We didn't grow up together, and she was visiting from travels abroad. She'd been living in Asia, where her husband was covering the Vietnam War for Time magazine. Her name's Janice. So Janice was visiting our home in Washington, D.C. I was 13 years old. And she was talking to Dad. I was in the kitchen. They were in the living room. And I remember very well, my sister was describing to Dad an event that had happened when she and her husband were at a dinner party in Saigon. It was at the American embassy there. They were actually the guests of honor. So this is a lot of years ago. This is back in the late 60s. Giving away a lot when I reveal this
face. I promise not to do the math.
But it's an important part of the story. So there was a different, people were living in a different environment in the 1960s. There were certain subjects that were taboo, things you didn't talk about. And among those things were black and white relationships, intermarriage, that sort of business. And it was also a time when a woman depended upon, some women, upon their husbands for their validation. I won't say that Janice depended upon her husband for validation, but she did seek his permission under some circumstances. Such was the case when they were in Saigon at this dinner party. The conversation, they were the only blacks there. There were a few people. And the conversation began about ancestry. The people around the table were sort of bragging about their roots. They were very pleased to have been descended from judge this, congressman that, magnate this, industrial magnate, whatever and whomever. Janice, of course, being a small R Republican, a small D Democrat, was very offended by this presentation. So she rises herself up. My sister's very elegant. She rises herself up to her greatest height. She looks at her husband who's sitting across the table. This is why I explained what the culture was like at that point, and sort of seeking permission for what she's about to say. And he kind of nods. And she says, "Well, I am descended from Thomas Jefferson." So in the 1960s, this was a shock to people's sensibilities. Today, not so much.
I imagine the room, I can't imagine what that was like.
Well, Janice said the room went dead silent. All you could hear was the silverware clanking against the china. Nobody said a word. And this is the story I heard my sister tell my dad. As I said, they were there in the 60s. By the time she was visiting us, this was in the 70s. I was in high school, middle school. And I was shocked because I was 13 years old.
So you'd never heard anything about this?
I'd never heard any of this. A lover of history. It was my best subject in school. And no one had told me that we were descended from the author of the Declaration of Independence and the third president of the United States. So I went to my dad after I heard this information.
So did you wait till Janice kind of cleared out?
I waited. And I waited until I was comfortable to take it to dad because I wondered why no one had told me this before. And when I asked my dad about it, my dad gave me a very simple answer. All he said was, "That's what they say." He didn't want to talk about it. There were many reasons my dad didn't want to talk about it. Among them, for Black people of a certain age, there was a shame attached to being descended from enslaved people. In order for us to have been descended from Thomas Jefferson, it would have meant that someone in our family, some women in our family, had been exploited in some way, perhaps abused in some way, harmed in some way, marginalized. It meant that there were slaves in our family, and people in that era didn't want to talk about it. It's quite different now, thank goodness. So I think it hurt my dad. He didn't want that conversation. But when I looked at him and assessed the credibility of my sister's assertion, I looked at Daddy. Daddy was 6'2". He's passed away. He was 6'2", freckle-faced, had a long nose with an interesting bridge in it. And in his youth, he had red hair. When I knew him, he was bald and gray. I came late in my parents' lives. So I thought, maybe there's something to this story.
There's some story back there, right?
There's something to this oral history. As I continued to press my dad about it, I had an insatiable curiosity. I still do. He finally admitted to me that his mother, who'd been dead for decades, was from Charlottesville. So I said to Dad, "Well, Daddy, Thomas Jefferson was from Charlottesville." And Dad, in his terse way, said, "I know." And that was the end of that for a while. So that's how I came into the story.
And then what happened from there? When did you sort of come back to it start trying to solve this mystery, I guess?
Well, I continued asking Dad. So it came up, my dad, as I explained, really didn't want to talk too much about this history. But he was my best source since almost everyone in his family passed away. And so I decided the best way to get Dad to talk to me was to engage in some of the activities he liked. He loved football. So I started watching football with my dad every Sunday.
Very sneaky.
I wouldn't say sneaky. I would say clever. And we became buddies, my daddy and I. And he finally started revealing to me much about his own history, much about his family's history, and what he knew of Thomas Jefferson and the oral history that connected us to them. Eventually, I met with his brother. And he knew a little bit more, shared some interesting facts with me, what my grandmother looked like. My dad didn't remember her because she died when he was quite young, what she was like, and some of the oral history he'd heard. From there, I became a journalist, so I had a natural instinct, a natural curiosity, picked up some investigatory skills, learned how to investigate, research skills, and began just digging. Reading, asking questions, meeting people who had known old people who had known my grandmother and my dad's other siblings before everyone passed away. In fact, someone had written a poem. One of the persons who knew my family had written a poem about the Jessups. And in that poem, she had made reference to the family being descended from Thomas Jefferson. So it became clear to me that it was something his family had talked about and had felt some pride in. And I talked to my sister because my sister was the source. She was the person from whom I first learned this story. And I asked her, where did you find out? How do you know? Dad didn't talk about it. And she told me something that has stuck with me and sticks with me to this day. She learned the story from a woman named Aunt Peachy. Now, Aunt Peachy was my grandmother's half-sister. I never knew Aunt Peachy. I never met her. Family didn't talk about her either. Not much. But Aunt Peachy lived with us toward the end of her life. She'd actually been a domestic worker. But the family she worked for turned her out after she had a stroke. So my family took her in. And Aunt Peachy used to talk about the family being descended from Thomas Jefferson. She told my sister, you're descendant, but I'm not, because she was a half-sister. Aunt Peachy couldn't read and she couldn't write, but she stuck to that story. And had it not been for this domestic worker, uneducated domestic worker, we wouldn't be sitting here talking about this story today.
And so you traced it back from there, and I'm trying to remember now what the specific connection you ended up finding.
Well, so literally, Tommy, decades went by. Throughout those decades, I claimed ties to Thomas Jefferson, and I assumed Sally Hemings, because that's all I knew. There was perhaps your listeners are familiar with the 1998 Foster study, DNA testing, that revealed Thomas Jefferson, the likely father of Sally Hemings' children. And so I embraced that, and my imagination couldn't conjure up anything else aside from being descended from Thomas Jefferson and Sally Hemings. It didn't occur to me in my underexposure to history, and I was a journalist, as I mentioned, so I was not a historian, that this was multi-generational. So just moving forward some 40 plus years, I started visiting Monticello, became a frequent guest. And as a result, I met a woman named Lucia Cinder Stanton, who is the foremost and the most renowned scholar on slavery at Monticello. And what Cinder and I uncovered through her work and my attachment to her was that I am, in fact, descended from Thomas Jefferson, but it wasn't through Sally Hemings. It was through one of Thomas Jefferson's great-great-grandsons and a woman named Rachel Robinson, who was my great-grandmother. So that was the tie. Thomas Jefferson's great-great-grandson and a woman named Rachel Robinson. It was not through Sally Hemings at all. This is a lifelong story.
Sure. I know I'm condensed. We're condensing here.
Yeah, and it can get confusing to people. Right. But in a linear way, I learned about it, about the Jefferson connection. Decades later, I came to Monticello and through circumstantial evidence discovered that I was likely descended from Thomas Jefferson through one of his great-great-grandsons, that I was also likely descended from a woman named Rachel Robinson. Remember now, my dad did not talk about his family, so he did not know his grandmother's name. His grandmother's name was Rachel Robinson. So what we did not know, what I didn't know at that point, and we're talking now just a couple of years ago, a few years ago, who Rachel Robinson was. So that's what we had to uncover. And that's where the big reveal came in for me in 2015. I had, we were doing research, Cinder and I, letters written by Jefferson's family. Remember now, we're talking the Thomas Jefferson Foundation, which keeps every letter Jefferson ever wrote that wasn't destroyed or any family member of his wrote. So it's a great resource. There was a lot of information there. And death certificates. We're looking at a death certificate from one of my great-grandmother's brothers, Rachel Robinson's brother. His name was Peter Robinson. On this death certificate, it asks who his mother was, what his mother's name was. And it says Sally Hemings. H-E-M-M-A-N-S. And Cinder says, that's, we waited, we slept on it. The next day she says, are you thinking what I'm thinking? I say, yeah, I am. Hemmings was a corruption of the spelling of the word Hemmings, the name Hemmings. So this Peter Robinson's mother was named Sally Hemmings. Now, she would not have been the famous Sally Hemmings. She would have been, we discovered, the niece of the famous Sally Hemmings. And this Peter was named after his grandfather. Peter Robinson was named after his grandfather, Peter Hemmings. Who was Peter Hemmings? A brother of Sally Hemmings. So, my eureka moment. No, I wasn't descended from Sally Hemmings. I was descended from Sally Hemmings' brother, Peter. So, in 2015, I confirmed that I am, in fact, a Hemmings, but through Peter, not through Sally. Why is this important? What does this tell us? It tells us that interracial relationships, no matter how they occurred, were multi-generational. They were multi-layered. It wasn't just Thomas Jefferson and Sally Hemmings. It was Thomas Jefferson's father-in-law, John Wales. It was Thomas Jefferson's son-in-law after his daughter died. His daughter Mariah died. A man named Epps. It was Jefferson's great-great-grandson, my great-grandfather. His name was Moncure Robinson Taylor. So it was complex. It was multi-generational. It was interlocking for decades, generations, and these were blood relations that we live with today.
I want to ask how you characterize these relationships. Obviously, many over generations, and as you said, in different families. I know I've read some thoughts that the only way to characterize sexual relationship between a master and a slave is rape. And I guess I just wonder what you, having studied this for so long and obviously put so much thought into it, how you see those relationships.
Well, there's such a huge power imbalance, master and the enslaved. It's very hard for me to call it rape because it's my ancestor. It's a painful word. So I don't. But I would be hiding, running away from the truth if I didn't acknowledge that my ancestors were compromised. My Black ancestors were compromised. That they were exploited. That they didn't have a choice. They didn't have a choice. Some people would call it rape. I can't bring myself to do so.
Did anything you found, did you find letters from the women in the family?
No.
Any of this? Anything that would
no.
help describe that on from their end?
Not a one. No. First of all, a lot of these people would have been illiterate. And then, even if they wrote letters, they would not have been seen as something to keep or maintain. And women are not going to write letters about how they're being abused or exploited or hurt or damaged. So, no, there's no documentary evidence as such. There are letters among white family members. But, of course, we're not going to see anything like that there. Keep in mind that Jefferson's daughter and his grandchildren in particular, one of whom is my four times great-grandfather, three times great-grandfather, it's hard to keep up, worked very hard to protect Jefferson's reputation. And they continued to deny throughout their lives that Jefferson and Hemmings had had a relationship or a connection and had had children. They blamed it on Jefferson's nephews or any white person who happened to have been around, but certainly not Thomas Jefferson. And for so long, scholars accepted that. That has changed as of This year, 2018, the Thomas Jefferson Foundation Monticello has acknowledged without qualification that Thomas Jefferson and Sally Hemings had 6 children together, 4 of whom survived into adulthood. So this is a real turning point in the history of how we understand the person Thomas Jefferson was and the life of Sally Hemings, which was in fact a life of sacrifice, because what she did, if I may talk about her for a minute, she was my great-great-great-great-aunt. Great-great-great-great-aunt, yes.
You have me counting your fingers.
Looking on my fingers now, yeah. Yes. And I'm proud of that connection. As I said earlier, I was claiming her before I knew there was actually a blood relationship there. Sally Hemings was a woman who at the age of 16, when she was in Paris with Jefferson, serving as a companion to his daughters, and where, according to her son Madison, the sexual relationship between Hemings and Jefferson began, she negotiated with him what her future would be. Jefferson wanted Sally Hemings to return to Virginia with him, and she demurred. She refused to do so because in France, she would have been free. She was free. But what she did was she bargained with him. He was 46. She was 16. He was a very influential man, even before he became president. She would have seen him as a powerful man, I would have thought. And what she did was she told this man, very much her senior, very much having much more power than she could ever have imagined to accrue for herself, said to him, "Sure, I'll come back to Virginia with you. I'll come back to Albemarle County, Charlottesville. But only if our children are free, and only if I'm granted certain privileges." And so that's what happened. She returned, and the children they had together were free. So Sally Hemings gave her descendants a 40-year jump on freedom in the United States of America, which really made a difference in their family. So she was remarkable. She was a remarkable woman.
And now there's an exhibit at Monticello about her, right? That's just recently opened.
There's an exhibit at Monticello that opened June 16th called The Life of Sally Hemings. It's one of many exhibits that opened that weekend. And it does explore her life as much as we can through the words of her son, acknowledging that she was a world traveler, a seamstress, a mother, a sister, and an emancipator, a liberator. Because of her sacrifice, she freed her children. I'd like you to think about what that meant. Hemings's children, at least 3 of her children who survived into adulthood, looked white. White enough to pass. 2 of them passed for white, including her only daughter, before she died. So that meant she knew she would have to let those children go. She would never see them again, because once you cross over that color line, you can't come back. You have to give up your family. She was giving up her children. When I think about it, it fills me with pain and hurt for her. I can't imagine never seeing my son again. But life in America in the 18th and 19th centuries was so oppressive for people of color that they were willing to give up their children so they could have a better life.
When we come back, Gail Jessup White talks about the white nationalist movement that has resurfaced in our country, and how she saw it up close and personal in Charlottesville. That and more ahead on Southbound.
Support for Southbound comes from WFAE members and Southeast Radiation Oncology Group, offering non-invasive alternatives to surgery and treatments in radiation oncology. Details at treatcancer.com. WFAE's music podcast, Amplifier, launches this week with new episodes each weekday. So what can you expect to hear? Conversations about the people, places, and things that make up the Charlotte music scene.
You know, a little dash of emotion, a sprinkle of keys, melody, you know.
Subscribe to the Amplifier podcast on WFAE.org/Amplifier. Amplifier is powered by Ortho Carolina.
Each week on Southbound, we take a moment to highlight our listeners. This week, I want to thank Matthew Tesner, who tweeted at me after our episode with college football writer Spencer Hall. Here's what Matthew said about Southbound. Every podcast is like combining a visit to a library of Southern history and culture with a late summer afternoon on a front porch with a slice of homemade fruit pie. Simply put, it's informative and delightful. Matthew, buddy, the check is in the mail. If you enjoy the podcast, we want to hear from you. Email me at ttomlinson@wfae.org, tweet at me at Tommy Tomlinson, or leave us a rating and review on Apple Podcasts. Subscribe to us on your favorite podcast provider, and we'll send you new episodes when they come out. Thanks for your support. And now back to our conversation with Gail Jessup White. I do feel like it sounds, you know, given the history, in retrospect, it feels like almost destiny that you should be there.
It does.
When did it first sort of dawn on you that this was a place that you could work and make a life out of?
I don't know when it first dawned on me. My husband and I moved to Richmond 12 years ago, second husband. Name is Jack White, Time Magazine correspondent. It's a bizarre coincidence that my oldest sister would have been married to a Time Magazine correspondent and that I would eventually marry another Time Magazine correspondent. Maybe the ancestors made that happen as well.
Yeah, you know.
Once we moved to Richmond, it made Charlottesville more accessible to me. So I started visiting frequently, and I fell in love with it. It's beautiful, and I love history. So there was a natural synergy there. I became a fellow there in 2014, in search of this history, trying to make this connection, trying to prove what Aunt Peachy had said, making the oral history, validating the oral history. So it seemed to me a natural place for me to find a professional home. What wasn't typically or particularly obvious was what that professional life would be. So in 2016, I guess it was, 2015, there was a story in the New York Times. Actually was an op-ed that was critical of the work that Monticello was doing in not revealing, according to this particular op-ed, the true stories of the enslaved at Monticello. Now, in defense of my organization, we had been working for 50 years in unraveling stories about the enslaved. But this criticism hurt. It bit. And it seemed like a good opportunity to bring someone on with my skill set. I'm a communications major, was a reporter and an anchor for a number of years, and a spokesperson for hire for a number of years. Someone with a connection to Monticello and with a love for the place because of its history and because of my history there. It seemed like a good opportunity to bring someone on board who could share with the public the work we're doing and the significance of it and how it's connected not just to Charlottesville and Virginia, but to the country. Monticello is a microcosm of the United States of America. It represents all the good and all the bad of the United States of America. It is who we are. I don't care what your ethnicity might be or what racial identity you might have. It belongs to all of us. It is our history. And so it seemed a natural place for me to share that, to find a home so I could share that history with other people.
And as the community engagement officer there, is part of what you do in reaching out to the community, telling your story as part of that? Or?
It is part of that. And the reason that matters is because the story that's my story is an American story. It belongs to all of us. And it's my hope that people, when they hear me or when they see me, see themselves and see what America can be. When Jefferson wrote the words, "All men are created equal," he was really, philosophically speaking, thinking of all men, all humans, but not practically speaking. But now, hundreds of years later, we're still working toward that aspiration. And we can never, ever stop until, in fact, those words become a reality for every single one of us, every one of us. And that's my message. My message is to invite people to come to Monticello to feel the beginnings of that history, to embrace that American aspiration, to leave Monticello feeling a part of a great country, and leave Monticello with a willingness to care for each other. We have to take care of each other.
Well, that, in my mind, brings me back a little bit to what you alluded to a few minutes ago about the events in Charlottesville last August, and then to a lesser extent, just a few days ago, as we talk now, about the white nationalists who came to town, and obviously one of them used his car and hit some counter-protesters, killed a young woman. And I guess I wonder, as someone with that message of unity and trying to see us all as one and trying to bring us together, how you see this as part of our history, and as a part, I think we talked a little bit before we got in front of the microphones that we were both a little surprised, maybe we shouldn't have been, that this is becoming a bigger part again in a way that it hasn't in a long time.
Well, what's shocking to me is that here we are in 2018, and some of the racial tension that at least I believed had been marginalized has resurfaced in a very intimidating way. I'm peachy. The woman, the oral history, woman who had the oral history, who passed down the words, "You're descended from Thomas Jefferson," also talked about the Ku Klux Klan walking down Pennsylvania Avenue. Thousands strong, I think it was 1925. Tens of thousands strong, actually. And when my sister told me Aunt Peachy would say that repeatedly, I thought, thank God that's over. I never imagined that I would see a Klansman in full regalia as I did last year in Charlottesville. The alt-right white nationalists came to Charlottesville 3 times last year. I was there the second time, not the third time, where a young woman, Heather Heyer, lost her life. But the second time, when Klansmen came dressed in their robes, they were so close to me that I could almost reach out and touch them. I never thought I'd see that in my lifetime. And here we are dealing with that today, 2018. Just a few days ago, the Klan threatened to walk again in Washington, D.C. on Pennsylvania Avenue. Fortunately, they weren't having that in my hometown. So there were only a couple dozen there and literally thousands of counter-protesters. Thank God. But that doesn't mean that their movement at this point is done or will be suppressed. We're living in a political climate where this kind of fractious environment is being encouraged. And we, as Americans have to stop it. And it can be in the smallest of ways. Smiling, looking at, you're white and I'm black, looking across from each other and smiling at each other and saying it's okay, because ultimately we are the same. We are all Americans. A lot of us share the same blood. The average black person in America is 18 to 24% European. There are a lot of white people in America who have African blood and they don't know it. We're all related. Stop fighting.
One last thing, and I think you may have answered this very well as we've spoken, but I want to kind of try to sum it up a little bit. All this that you've learned about your family history over all these years, how has this affected the idea of who you are?
So here's what's changed for me. I grew up very much a part of the black community in Washington, D.C., a middle-class black community in Washington, D.C. That means that we didn't talk about race in my family. We were Catholic. We talked about being Catholic. So I've always embraced, enjoyed, reveled in being the person I am. I was also not interested in being an activist in any respect. I did not want to discuss issues of race once I found out what that meant to be black in America and not black in D.C. I did not want to feel a part of a targeted group or an oppressed group or a marginalized group. I didn't want to know that people were watching me when I walked in a department store. If that happens, I don't notice it because I don't want to notice it. But the reality is, that's who I am. And uncovering this truth about my family, understanding who they were, recognizing, as my dad did not, that there were many enslaved people in my family, and that's just part of American history. That has changed me. That has made me, that and my son. I have, as I mentioned, I have a 26-year-old son. And he's the most important person in my life. I love my husband. This is my son. And he is 6'1", broad-shouldered, walks with a strong stride, very vocal and very active, very smart young man. And I worry every single moment I'm awake that something's going to happen to my son because of how he looks, because of the color of his skin. So between that and uncovering the history, between that concern for my son and people like him, that has changed the person I am and what I hope to accomplish on what years I have left here on earth. I want this to be a safe place for all of us, an embracing place for all of us. I want this to be a home where, in fact, all men are created equal. All humans are created equal and treated as such. So, yes, my life has changed in ways I could never, ever have imagined, and for the better. It's harder, Tommy, but it's better.
Thank you, Gail.
Thank you.
If Gail Jessup White's journey teaches us anything, if her life teaches us anything, it's a simple lesson. We are all connected. Most of us don't have to go back too far through our ancestors to discover that we might need a new definition of what family means. And when you look at it that way, when you pull back the camera for the wide shot, it becomes clear that most of our fighting is not with one another, but with ourselves. To deny our blended history is to deny who we are. It seems to me that the anger of so many white nationalists comes from the growing knowledge that not only are they not superior, but they're not completely white either. None of us are purebreds. And the larger question is this: Why would you want to be? Southbound is a production of WFAE in Charlotte. Our producer is Nick Della Canale. Our web manager is Jennifer Lang. Our audience engagement producer is Joni Deutsch. And our main theme music comes from Josh Turner. You can listen to this and other episodes on the NPR One app, iTunes, or wherever else you listen to podcasts. You can also find Southbound on WFAE.org, where each episode has show notes and links with more information on that week's guest. Also, between episodes, look for the Southbound Radio Hour with a playlist of music based on the most recent episode. See y'all next time. Thanks for listening.
Support for Southbound comes from WFAE members and Southeast Radiation Oncology Group, offering non-invasive alternatives to surgery and treatments in radiation oncology. Details at treatcancer.com. Additional support is provided by the Knight Foundation.